Welcome to the Ancient Christian Writers series, led by Father David Abernethy of the Pittsburgh Oratory of St. Philip Neri in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The following recording is a reading and discussion of The Spiritual Life by St. Theophane the Recluse. Our ability to provide podcasts free of charge is made possible by the generosity of listeners like you. If you would like to make a contribution in support of our ministries, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org. Your interest and prayerful support are appreciated. God bless you and enjoy the podcast.
Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Hey, welcome back to our study of St. Theophane's correspondence with Anastasia. And we're picking up again this evening with letter 65. And we're currently on page 257, the second paragraph, beginning with a person who repents. And he's been speaking to her and quoting to her, St. Poman on the God-pleasing life. And so this is where we're picking up here this evening. How it is that one overcomes the passions and sows the virtues. And then when we get into the next letter, it's sort of interesting, something that we don't often hear of making a pilgrimage and some of the things that the spiritual benefits of that, but also the spiritual practices that she would engage in while making this pilgrimage. He encourages her to walk and in the journey to this monastery of a famous saint, Saint Sergius of Russia. But he sort of coaches her along in terms of what that experience will be like and also the spiritual practices that she should engage in along the way. But again, we're picking up on the second paragraph of page 257 of the text. A person who repents and grieves over his sins naturally shuns evil and does good. Until he is this way, he may not undertake to do evil by deed, but he cannot be free from wicked thoughts. That is why shunning of evil consists almost entirely in struggle with the thoughts. This is what St. Poman talks about. So, he's beginning to tie the struggle with one's thoughts to the performance of good deeds and fostering a virtue, linking these two together in the sense of growing in the spiritual life, that unless these two are paired, that we can continue to struggle with the evil thoughts over the course of time. What would be ideal is to struggle with the thoughts that would lead to the awakening of certain desires and then feelings and passions that would arise out of them, but also to be fostering the virtues as well as positive thoughts through spiritual reading and other exercises in such a way that one begins to lose that attraction to those things that are evil or sinful. And so long as one doesn't do that, doesn't foster the virtue and doesn't foster these positive elements, we can labor and continue to labor in a kind of fierce way with the thoughts. We might grow in virtue. He's not saying that that's an impossibility, but we'll always continue to struggle with those evil thoughts unless something greater comes to take over our heart, as it were. It's sort of like the story from the gospel of Jesus talking about a demon being cast out, and you know the house is put in order, but then seven other demons come back, far worse than, and the situation is far worse than when it began. That it's not only necessary for us to cast out that which is evil from within, but for something greater to enter in to the house, to our home, to our hearts, and to fill our hearts in such a way that it doesn't allow those demons to return to us. And unless Christ dwells within our hearts, then then we're always going to be vulnerable to the attack of the evil one and to the thoughts that are put before us. And it's, you know, it might seem like a small point, but I think it's actually one of the more essential points of these couple of letters that so far much of our discussion is focused on dealing with the passions and overcoming them, and not so much upon the fostering of virtue and of the positive thoughts and filling the memory and the imagination with things that nourish us and develop it, help us to develop a greater intimacy with Christ. Okay. He goes on to say, one of the brothers went to Abba Poman and said to him, "Father, I have many thoughts and I am in danger because of them." The old man took him outside and said, "Expand your chest and do not inhale." "I cannot do that," answered the brother. "If you cannot do that, then neither can you stem the flow of the thoughts," said the old man. "But your job is to resist them." So our job, you know, our primary job is to resist the thoughts that come upon us. And as we've mentioned so many times before, that a great part of the spiritual battle is psychological and emotional, that thoughts will stir up many different things for us. And often our memories, our imagination will be clouded with such things, and it becomes very difficult to remove them once they have become deeply ensconced within the mind and the heart. Your job is to resist them, but how? First of all, be attentive to yourself and be sober. A brother said that when he was with others, he would amuse himself and return to his cell, not the same as when he left it. He asked how he should act. The elder told him, "When you return to your cell, do you want to find yourself the same as when you left? Maintain vigilance over yourself, both at home and outside the home." In general, Abba Poman would say, "The thing you need most is a sober mind." So this is a thought that I think are being exposed to for the first time within the text. It may have been mentioned in passing, but much more direct explanation of it here. Sobriety, and it's not avoiding intoxication from alcohol. It's not what he's talking about. It's maintaining a kind of stable state of mind and stable focus upon our Lord, so that our state within the cell, or for the monk in the cell, would be the same as when he left, that he would engage himself in such a way that he would maintain that watchfulness of mind and heart. He would not become, in exiting the cell and engaging others, drunk, as it were, upon the amusements of the world, and so fill himself to such an extent that when he would return to his cell, his mind would be distracted, he would be agitated, or he would just be dwelling upon these things that he had encountered in conversations with others or saw within the world. I think for us, it's telling us that in our day-to-day life, we want to foster a kind of lifestyle where we maintain a kind of recollection and focus upon God. That is constant throughout the course of the day, and to hold on to that, that the more that we allow ourselves to be distracted in large ways by things, where we lose sight of God altogether, and that can be something as simple as our daily work, where we become so absorbed that we lose sight of God altogether. And I was talking to a man today where we were discussing this, that towards the end of the day, that he was saying that, you know, I can get very focused upon the work. You know, I've, you know, been engaged all day in the labor, and it intensifies towards the end of the workday for him, to the point where he notices that he can be completely absorbed in it. Whereas I think our goal would be, you know, to break that labor, not necessarily for long periods of time, but to turn the mind and the heart to God again and again throughout the day, so that as we engage in that labor, it's not done outside of the context of that relationship with God. And it's, our work is not done in such a way that we lose that vigilance, that sobriety of mind as we go through our day, so that we aren't exposing ourselves indiscriminately to the things of the world, the amusements, the distractions that are all going to pull us out of that relationship with God or that attentiveness towards Him. And, you know, we've talked so many times before that we move from distraction to distraction. And it's pretty hard to maintain this sobriety in the ways that the fathers speak of. And I think this is part of the reason that they went to the desert in order to avoid those things, that they could cut off with one swipe so many of the things that could so easily distract us. And so, in a sense, almost our maintaining of this kind of sobriety takes more from us in regards to this kind of discipline. And so as we begin this our day, you know, that our focus would be on God and that we would be asking Him to bless our labors and that He would keep us by His grace from moving away from Him, that we would be able to maintain that intimacy and communion with Him throughout the course of the day. And this is why the practice of something like the Jesus Prayer helps us to maintain that sobriety, this constant movement toward God and then back to our labors and engaging them fully and then back to God in order that we do not lose sight of Him and that and become abstracted from Him. Okay. Any questions about sobriety in general and what he's talking about here in these paragraphs? So once again, he's exposing her to one of the great spiritual writers. And Abba Poman was, you know, certainly one of the great early fathers and great spiritual guides. And so, again, he's connecting her to the broader tradition more than just what he's been teaching her. When maintaining vigilance over yourself, as soon as you observe the passionate, immediately pray and it will go away. A brother asked Abba Poman about the struggle with rebellious thoughts, and the elder answered him, "The situation is like a man who has a fire on one side and a cup of water on the other. When the fire begins to scorch, he takes water from the cup and puts it out. Fire is the suggestion of the enemy, the passions, while water is earnest prayer to God." And so this movement to constant prayer throughout the day to prevent the passions from flaming up within us, that it's like sprinkling water on a fire that begins to spark and get out of control, that the constant prayer helps us to maintain that kind of sobriety of heart that he was speaking of in the previous paragraph. To suffer less from passionate thoughts, it is necessary to remove oneself from occasions that arouse them. One must remove himself from everything passionate, said Abba Poman. A man who is close to something that could engender passion is like someone standing over a deep precipice into which the man's enemy may easily throw him. But the man who removes himself from that which is capable of arousing passion is like someone standing far from the precipice. Let the enemy drag him so as to toss him into the abyss. But while he is dragging him along by force, the man will call out to God and God will help him. So a very kind of simple counsel, but nonetheless important, that we don't want to live our life walking along the edge of the abyss. And often we don't need the evil one to drag us there. I think there have been certainly many times in my own life that I've found myself walking along the edge of the abyss and sort of even dangling a foot over. And, you know, but his advice here is very good, that we would live our life in such a way that we would seek to stay away from the things that we know are going to give rise to the passions, so that even if they do take a hold of us and begin to drag us towards the committing of a particular sin, that in that time, as they're dragging us and taking hold of us, we can be calling out to God for his aid and his grace. And so often avoiding that near occasion of sin is how we often will describe it. is enough to keep us from falling into it. Even when we are inclined to move towards it through the temptation of our own thoughts or the temptation of the evil one. And often we will flirt with that near occasion in the similar way that we often flirt with the idea of walking along the edge of the abyss. I'm always amused but also terrified by these people who take these selfies. They'll climb up on the edge of this cliff and they'll climb out on a rock and to take a selfie of themselves with that big stick that they hold the phone on, and they're hanging over a cliff. And there's been multiple occasions when these people have like fallen off of these mountainsides because they were trying to take a selfie, and it's sort of putting oneself in harm's way. And on a spiritual level, we will often do the same thing. We can become focused upon ourselves and satisfying our own desires in the moment that we do foolish things, that we will put ourselves in harm's way. And we think that we can flirt for a while with it. You know, something that's a little bit more dangerous. And maybe we do this with things in social media or music or television or even certain conversations with people. And we'll flirt with it for a while, thinking that, you know, that we're not putting ourselves in any immediate danger. But the longer that we flirt with it, we can end up falling into the precipice if the evil one takes hold of us or floods us. You know, if you remember St. Theophan talking about at times there being an eruption of thoughts that come upon us, and the evil one can sort of attack us in a furious fashion, and so we can be overwhelmed. And so that's why there's such a danger when we do place ourselves in those near occasions of sin, because when there is this eruption that takes place and we're overwhelmed by our own thoughts and feelings, then even when we try to call out to God at that point, we can end up falling. And so best to stay far removed. So no mountain climbing. Ashley. So, any thoughts so far? Pretty straightforward, but this is a very important letter, I think. I know I've said that probably multiple times before, but nonetheless, it is, despite the simplicity of it. I think Andrea was the first to pop up there.
It's actually me, Father.
Okay.
So, you know, when I was a child, I had this experience. I was born in Peru, right next to the sea. And one time we were at the sea, I went too far into the sea, and the current came in and it almost trapped me. You know, I was fighting with all of my force to try to get out of it, and the current was pulling me back, and I was there for like a minute just fighting with all of my strength, you know, to not fall into, and finally the current let me go, and I was able to get out of it. But
that's actually a wonderful example. Go ahead, I'll let you finish up.
At the end, I was completely exhausted. And you know, I find myself like that many times. You know, you're talking about that avalanche of feelings and passions, and then you know you're there struggling, and then I at least for myself, you know, I don't, maybe others are better at this, but I find myself completely wiped out, completely exhausted, and
right.
Yeah, I guess, you know, wondering about where the part of the yoke be easy and the burden light comes in, because I'm not feeling it at that moment.
That's right. Well, at that point we aren't wearing the yoke, as it were. You know, I think the yoke and the burden that is placed upon us is Christ's own spirit, perfectly fit for the work to be done. And so there's something about that yoke that lifts us up and isn't a burden to us and weighs us down. And it's when we set that off, when we cast that off and we take upon ourselves the yoke and the burden of the world, is when we find ourselves crushed and pulled down. I think the term for what you describe, riptide, is that what takes place, that a person I've heard of people being in certain places, the force of that is so great that it can pull them like a mile out into the ocean, right? That it can be so fierce at times. And that's how people often will drown, in fact, that it's so powerful that they can't get themselves out of it. And the water, I don't even think has to be all that particularly deep, depending upon the strength of the current. And so that's what makes it, I think, a really powerful example for what Theophan is talking about here, that something like that can come upon us so quickly that even when we begin to try to fight at that moment, we're yanked by the current. And then even if we do emerge, find ourselves completely exhausted. Very good. Ashley.
I was just going to say, I was kind of going to echo what he just said with it being exhausting. During confession, I was talking with the priest about like a near occasion of sin that I didn't avoid. And it was completely my ego that was getting in the way, obviously, because I thought I could just battle through it. And it was exhausting. But is there also, because we talked about also like this lack of trust in God. So could that also be at play there?
Yeah, I think that's a big thing for us, actually, a lack of trust in the grace of God. And that, you know, we aren't calling out to him completely. And so either we aren't acknowledging our own poverty in the sense that we are clinging to him, knowing our own weakness and that we can be pulled into these sins. Or we're not trusting in that grace enough that when we find ourselves afflicted, that we aren't calling out to him. Like the examples are saying here, that, you know, even when we're at a distance from the precipice, often we will go for a long time before calling out to God. We can find ourselves afflicted, but continue to go on, maybe even laboring in some sense against it. But what is at play there is a lack of faith in God and a lack of trust in his grace, that we would immediately call out to him. And so, you know, it is pride that often is our undoing, you know, that we rest on our own strength. And that in particular can be a danger for those who have made some gains, I think, within the spiritual life, and some control over their passions. The fathers often talk about how subtle the evil one can do, or how he can be patient, that he can, you know, present us with certain temptations, but then sort of withdraw, and or we can expose ourselves to certain near occasions of sin and overcome them, not be moved by them, and let that go on for a while without attacking us, with sort of a vision down the line that he can see us flirting, as it were, with the potential sin, and wait and bide his time and allow us to continue to do that to the point that we think, okay, I've gained a certain level of freedom. I'm not moved by that passion. You know, I'm an old guy in my late 50s, and so that part of me isn't as strong anymore, kind of thing. And before you know it, you know, it can awaken with you know, great strength. And it's a terrible danger, because often it's those who've been in the spiritual life or engaged in that battle for many years, and the fall can be great. You know, it's sort of like St. John's ladder, that the higher up on your the ladder you are, the greater the fall, and the more dangerous pride becomes at that point, to begin to rest in oneself as though those spiritual gains have been simply through the strength of one's will, and or where we begin to attribute our, you know, those gains in the spiritual life to ourselves and our own fidelity, where it's really been God who's been carrying us all along.
So it's almost like the enemy leads us into a sort of, maybe not complacency, but this idea that we don't necessarily need a savior at that point, right, from this thing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We don't stray too far from what Adam and Eve did. you know, that, you know, eat of the fruit of the tree and you'll become like gods. You know, we can gain a certain kind of knowledge of the spiritual life, but not really wisdom that arises, that comes from experience. And today I was reading from St. Mark the Ascetic, where he was talking about this, that one might have, you know, this capacity to articulate things about the spiritual life, be very well read, but not necessarily have knowledge that arises out of that, that one falls into a kind of folly because, you know, they begin to trust in what is within the mind, the understanding, rather than what arises out of experience of that battle. And the experience of that battle is going to tell someone that they need to be prudent and they need to stay away from the things that would lead them into sin. And so often this kind of worldly knowledge, even if it is about spiritual things, breeds hubris, you know, that we begin to trust too much within, you know, in ourselves. All right. So I'm at the bottom of the second paragraph. Is that correct? Is that right? Okay. The most important thing is to try in every way possible not to give in to the thoughts. For encouraging this, we read the following things about St. Poman. A brother asked him whether a person could always suppress his thoughts without yielding to the enemy a single one. The elder answered, "There are those who suppress 10 but yield one." That very same brother asked the same thing of Abbas Sissos, and he said, "Indeed, there are those who yield nothing to the enemy." So, you know, this is kind of an encouraging thing for us, that even in the face of the multiplicity of the thoughts that come upon us, that the vigilance, the sobriety that Theophan is speaking about here through Abba Poman, that one can get to a point where there is this sobriety, attentiveness, that one doesn't give oneself over to those thoughts, or only in a minimal way, one in 10, which is still a dangerous thing for us, even one, but nonetheless, it's possible. And I think, you know, we often don't believe that, I think, because most of our life, or a great portion of our life, is spent in not having that sobriety and not being taught to shape one's life in order that we guard the mind and the heart, and that we don't allow the thoughts to wander, or that we avoid the kind of idleness that Theophan was talking to Anastasia about last week. And so we allow ourselves to fall into that idleness, and we allow our thoughts to go where they will. And so when we enter into the spiritual life and we begin to become aware of the fact that the battle can be largely psychological, and with the thoughts, it can seem terribly overwhelming, that throughout the course of any given day, we can find ourselves constantly afflicted, not only in those times of the eruption of thoughts that Theophan talks about, but just because we've been so unguarded for so many years, that when we begin to first enter into the discipline of it, we begin to realize, oh my gosh, there's a lot more going on there than I ever imagined. Just the awareness of starting to enter into the spiritual battle, suddenly you see, you know, the horizon opens before you, or it's like you come up to the top of a hill, and the outspreading across the horizon is this huge army, like the golden horde, you know, that you're standing in front, who are, you know, ready to cut you down. You catch a vision of the enemy that you're facing, and it can be somewhat overwhelming. And I think that's where we have to cling to the practices that Theophan puts before us, in particular the Jesus Prayer, become very much aware of the presence of the saints, of Christ, and be constantly, you know, calling upon the Spirit. Otherwise, we can fall into a kind of despondency when we see that and think that, you know, that no matter what I do, Because especially early on, we rest so much upon our own strength and our own will, or we really haven't developed the discipline in order to sustain the sobriety that Theophan is talking about here. And so when we grow fatigued, we sort of throw up our hands and say, I just can't do it. You know, God is too demanding. You know, this is torturous. You know, why doesn't he help me more? You know, we get angry. We get angry with God, you know, that he allows us to remain in that struggle. Carl or Sawyer?
I just had a question about your thoughts on how to introduce these. I mean, I know you've talked about these books for kids, but as far as this idea of kind of monitoring thoughts and like what age is appropriate to start that with, and what do you have ideas about a good way to kind of introduce that and make that kind of a practice from a younger age?
Yeah, you know, a couple thoughts come to mind, and we've mentioned this before, that how some of these great inventors, you know, what was his name, Steve Jobs, and you know, all these other ones, won't let their kids play with a tablet or whatever it is, an iPad, and they'll keep them away from those things because they know how stimulating they can be and addicting. And same thing with television and things like that, that over the course of years, you know, parents, I think, have gotten used to allowing their kids to, or even put them before the television in order to keep them, you know, their attention focused on something for a period of time. And not to be critical, you know, I think probably parents are going nuts half the time and get desperate. And so, okay, take your iPad, or okay, let's put the television on and watch something for a little while. But you know, I think before the advent of the internet, and thinking back just to my own childhood, that there were more times spent in silence, even in play. That I remember growing up, and you know, this is a little bit of a digression, but you know, I would play with Hot Wheels, and I would develop these like elaborate tracks, you know, and build them across the room and everything. And I was playing alone at home at that point, you know, but I could do that for hours. And there wasn't that kind of intense stimulation where the mind and the heart is agitated. There was a kind of focus to that. And if you remember Theophan telling her to avoid this idleness, to keep the mind focused on certain things. And I mentioned how my grandfather would say, okay, get out there and push, you know, use the push broom to get rid of the soot from the porch, you know, that he would, you know, if he saw you standing around or sitting on your hands, you know, he'd put you to work, kind of thing. Activities often would involve silence in one way or another. You know, the uncle who taught art, or the uncles who took us fishing, you know, so that you could be out on a stream for 8 hours and maybe see somebody way down the stream, but your focus is on that task. And what I'm getting at here is that there are all these natural ways that people could enter into silence and be comfortable with themselves and not need to fill their minds with all of these things. And so things could sort of slow down for them on this very natural level, simply by being within, certainly within just in nature itself. And so in some ways I was fortunate that way, and to some of the things that I was exposed to. And now we sort of move to this immediate involvement in organized things, you know, whether it's in, you know, earlier and earlier preschool. And I think we begin to think, well, we need to give our children the greatest advantages that we can to socialize them, to begin, give them this kind of head start. But there is something about this unorganized play that I think that is really important in terms of the formation of a person's creativity, but I think also this not overstimulating them at an early age, because I think in these formative periods, we often form how our minds work and how we perceive the reality around us. And so if at an early age where you're sort of constantly being agitated or thrust into these situations that force us to process too many things at one time, that we find ourselves, even when we get a little bit older, either needing that or, you know, find ourselves sort of in this constant agitated state. So even on a natural level, I think with children that you would seek to form them to be comfortable with silence and to be comfortable with themselves, or reading books, you know, would be another way of doing that, that it can be very engaging to the mind and the story is very rich, but the child is still in silence and absorbed in the story before them. And so there's something very positive about that. And certainly there are a lot of ways that we can work in religious elements to that in terms of the lives of the saints, you know, that are appropriate for children. And even in terms of taking them to church, you know, from a very early age, there is this kind of fostering of this being in the presence of God and with this community that are worshiping together, where there is this focus of attention of what's going on at the altar. So even if they're not grasping it, they're being exposed to the whole experience that begins to shape the mind and the heart in all these subtle ways. So whether it's, you know, the Western Latin rite or Eastern rites, you know, in their own way, there's something deeply formative about that. And then the home environment, I think, in and of itself, it doesn't mean, you know, that they have to treat their bedrooms as cells, you know, get to your room, you know, and lock your kids up in the room, but that the house would have a certain tone to it. And, you know, kids play, and certainly being rambunctious and all that stuff is a normal part of formation and development. But having a peaceful home, household, and, you know, how the parents interact with each other and how they interact with the children and what the parents are engaged in can make a huge difference. Growing up, you know, on the weekends, it was something, it wasn't always very pleasant, you know, labor, but my dad had this love of like taking care of the yard. You know, I think that was a big thing for him, you know, that this was something that he owned and took care of and wanted to see beautiful. But every weekend we were out there raking leaves and, you know, it was just, you could count on it, you know, and, I always have the story of my sister should always say, you know, I've got to go to the bathroom. I'm just going to run inside. And then like an hour later, I'm saying, where in the heck is she? And I'd sneak into the house and she'd have her headphones on, listen to the records. And it always used to make me mad because he'd just say, you know, just leave her in there. And I was like, you know, I'm out here raking these, you know, leaves. And, but that was another way, you know, that this engagement in projects or working in the yard, working with one's hands, which again, I think is something that we've lost. And that could take place in many different ways, you know, whether it's, you know, cooking, baking, working in the yard, building things, you know, these are all kinds of work that allow a kind of recollection. And I think as a person grows and makes that connection with and their relationship with God grow, then those things work together very well. That as one is engaged in that labor, that there we can live in this more of a perpetual state of recollection. And, you know, children are like sponges. And sometimes we tell ourselves, you know, that, okay, they're incapable of this abstract thought. And so we avoid exposing them to religious ideas. And we think that somehow they won't grasp it. But that's not true. I mean, they're created by God. They're created in their image and likeness. And so as adults are, you know, we are created for him and we have a built-in longing for God. And that's true for children as it is for adults. You don't have to be able to think abstractly to be able to experience the living God. And so in many different ways, children can begin to experience that, and sometimes on a very deep level. You know, I've heard of these children at very early ages, you know, where they have been exposed in a consistent way because of the piety of their family, that, you know, we might call it precociousness, you know, but they sort of develop very quickly on that level, that it seems unusual to us, because I think our tendency is to treat children as if they're incapable of entering into this kind of relationship with God and beginning to develop the things that really would foster that relationship. And so it's interesting, you know, I think, you know, a lot of my uncles weren't particularly religious, but the ones that were most involved in nature and things like that, or appreciated it, you know, I could see, especially as I got older, that they could see something in that, that there was something precious about that to them. For them, that was their way of experiencing God. You know, I had an uncle who, you know, who is faithful, and but was a, you know, game commissioner. And so he could, you know, very much immersed in that, and could see in the beauty of creation itself, you know, something of, you know, the presence of God. In fact, he lived in State College, which I think they call God's country, you know, and I think there's a reason for that, because there's a beauty, a natural beauty to it. I don't know if that answers your question, or if you want to add to it or go a little further.
Yeah, and just as far as, like, I guess in a maybe a teen, as I get in adolescent years, the actual idea of monitoring, I mean, you were mentioning this, which was my experience of this kind of hitting it suddenly as an adult and it being this whoa, and kind of went to concretely introduce that.
You know, I think again, the witness of the parents at prayer is always the most powerful thing. You know, mimesis, imitation, the mimicking. You know, that this is how a lot of learning takes place. And so when they see their parents on their knees praying, and we have this holy half hour for children here at the Oratory, it's just once a month. But, you know, it's sort of interesting, you know, to hear them in there, you know, singing the prayers as the Eucharist is being exposed, you know, and holding their candles and things like that, so that they begin to, you know, pick these things up very quickly, and when they see their parents praying and that kind of piety within them. But I think parents have to be involved on all these different levels, you know, in the sense that they are aware of what we are discussing here. And we've talked so many times before about those who struggle with pornography, that they are exposed to it at an incredibly early age. That most of the people that I've talked to, I have a sense that it's around 12. A lot of the studies say 8 years old is when children are first exposed to pornography. And we all know that it's not like it was in the past, like 50 years ago, that there's something that is purposely addictive, meant to draw people in. And same thing with video games. You know, there is this a kind of addictive quality that you sort of are able to go to different levels constantly in an unending way that pulls a child in. And I think pornography works in the same way. I think it's Father Seraphim Rose who said that pornography is the devil's iconography. And there was some truthfulness to that, you know, that there is, like with icons, you know, gazing at pornography, something that draws one into this deeper reality that is corruptive, and that does corrupt the heart in this profound way. And so having ways to, you know, being attentive and guarding and watching your children's heart when they perhaps aren't capable of doing that, because all these things are so seductive, but also then exposing them to the images of things that are formative, that do draw them into the experience of the divine. You know, having a house, having walls of your rooms filled with icons would be a good way of doing it, you know, because there's something that, again, in seeing those things, they begin to identify with them and they become etched very deeply upon the imagination. And there's so much, you know, beautiful religious art, architecture. Father Drew, who was a priest here for many years, and I think in some of the other groups I've talked about this story, but one day he was at Heinz Memorial Chapel here at the University of Pittsburgh, and it has the high sustained stained glass windows in the States, and it's modeled after Saint-Chapelle in France. And he saw, it was a beautiful sunny day, and when it's very sunny, the windows in Heinz Chapel become magnificent. In fact, there is a color of blue in the stained glass windows that was lost with the death of the artist that unfortunately, so brilliant and beautiful. But he was waiting for the beginning of Mass one day when we used to have Mass there, and he saw a father bring his little girl in with her eyes covered with her hands. And he said, "Keep your eyes covered now." And he walked her, you know, by the hand into the center of the truth, in the center of the church. And then he said to her, "Now open your eyes." And, you know, in opening her eyes, she has, you know, this flood of color, but beauty, the beauty of it, but also all the religious figures as well. And the beauty of the architecture that raises the mind and heart. See, these are the kind of sensibilities that I think parents would want to have, because they are so simple. But it shows that the parents themselves have already taken that path, that they have this experience in their own life where they've been exposed to these things that have been deeply formative, and then they pass them on to their children. And, you know, so it's sort of like, you know, a father who is a fisherman, you know, or a father who is a hunter and spent time in the woods growing up as a kid, it's pretty likely that he's going to expose his sons or daughters to the same thing, you know, when they're growing up too, because of the joy that he had in those things. And when it comes to religion, there has to be that same kind of joy and enthusiasm that is expressed in the practice of that faith. And it has to be something genuine. Like, there's no doubting a father who loves fishing. Let's get the poles and we're going. And you're up at the crack of dawn and you go, you know. And so when it comes to the practice of religion, it should be the same thing, you know. It's funny, at one point, I don't know if it's here or which book I was reading. It might be Theophan, but in one of these books, I'm reading so many now, I can't remember. But in one of them, it was talking about keeping vigils. And it's saying that, you know, I think it might actually be St. John Chrysostom. Yeah, it was. It was Chrysostom was talking about night vigils for those living in the world. And his whole thing is that this, you know, holiness of life and these spiritual practices are valid for everyone. The context in which they are lived is different and how they are lived. But he said that, you know, the parents would get into this practice of breaking in the night for prayer and engage in that prayer because of the deep silence that is involved at that time really enriches that prayer. And so that should become a regular kind of spiritual discipline. And he said, with the children, you would do the same thing. Now, he said, they won't be able to sustain it very long, but you might have them get up and say a prayer and then go back to bed. And it was sort of jarring to me, because the thought of, you know, waking up a kid, you know, for night vigils is completely foreign. You know, the idea of letting them stay up late to watch, you know, movies or things like that wouldn't faze us. But the idea of keeping night vigils, you know, was sort of surprising. But I get it. You know, he's saying, while they're young, you're forming these patterns and ways of relating to God, even if in this small way, they get up in the night and they say this prayer, they turn their mind, the heart to God, and then they go back to bed. Okay. All right. Father Miron and Sarah.
I just had a comment about kind of what you were just talking about. Miron and I pray in the morning with the baby, and more than anything, we notice that there will be just random times where, you know, the baby's in his bouncer sitting between Christ and the Theotokos, and Miron and I are on either side, and the baby will just stop and then smile and then like kick his legs like crazy. That's excitement. Usually what he does when he's like, right, sees someone, like when we walk into a room, that's what he does. He's so excited to see us.
Or when we talk to him.
Or when we talk to him, you know, and it's been quiet for, you know, a couple of minutes, and then he hears our voice or something. And it's, it kind of just takes me down a level of like, who's actually right here? And I don't ever realize it. I'm just, you know, saying my morning prayers willy-nilly, and this little tiny innocent beautiful
something.
Yeah, a beautiful baby is actually like experiencing Christ and the Theotokos and all of these saints like right in front of us.
Right. Well, see, I think that's the truth about little children. They begin to recognize and identify certain things, you know, and certain images of saints, Christ, you know, and respond to that. And I'd mentioned here once before, you know, Becca, who works for us, and her husband were babysitting a little girl once, and it got later into the night, and the baby kept like pointing at the bookshelf, and they kept trying to figure out, because she wasn't able to say clearly what she wanted. And she became more and more agitated about it. And they were pulling books off the shelf and all kinds of stuff, trying to figure out what this kid wanted. And they never figured it out. And then when the parents got home, they told them that there was a box on top of the bookshelf that had the rosaries in it for the family rosary. And so every night the family would gather to say the rosary together. And that had become such a part of her life that there was this expectation that this would be done, even when the parents were out of the house and she was being watched by somebody else. There was this expectation that this was part of the routine of the day-to-day life. And without it, she became, you know, very agitated. And, you know, we can say to ourselves, well, you know, that's a pretty basic connection that's being made there, or, you know, that this is a pattern of life that they're responding to. So, I mean, I think that's true. You know, you're establishing these positive patterns, and it's not whether or not a person, again, can grasp it intellectually or on an abstract level. It's experiential, that this had become part and parcel of this little girl's life. And that's the important thing, and what is sustained over the course of time and then deepens as they become more and more aware. Okay. All right. Where did I leave off? Here. Okay. Another, Abba Anub asked Abba Poman about impure thoughts that are engendered in the human heart, and about vain desires. Abba Poman answered him, "Shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith? Do not give them a hand, and they will not do anything. So, shall the axe boast itself against him that hews it?" Okay. So he's talking here about impure thoughts that are engendered within the human heart. Do not give them a hand and they will do nothing. So the hand itself in picking up the axe is not going to do anything. It's not like the hand axe alone. It's the human person that makes the decision to take up the axe and wield it. And in a similar way, it is we who take hold of these thoughts and allow them to guide or direct us, or we use them in the way that we want to satisfy us. So if we do not take hold of them, then they are not going to guide us eventually they will fade and lose their capacity to guide and direct us. On some level, we are giving over our will to these thoughts to pull us and direct us where they will. And that's where, you know, responsibility comes into play here, that, you know, it's not always that we are, you know, we can get to a point where we are driven by our thoughts because they become so habitual, they've become so deeply rooted. But there's still a responsibility that at some point we freely gave ourselves over to them through negligence, through laziness, through, you know, fostering them, you know, in even a very deliberate way, to the point that they've taken hold of us. And there's, in this spiritual battle, we sort of have to take responsibility for that in a humble way. You know, we can, like I was saying, that we can become so frustrated with the fact that we're being drawn down again and again in that spiritual battle by these thoughts, that we can become very angry at God. Why are you not helping me? And in reality, God is offering us all the grace that is necessary in order to fight that battle. But we have given ourselves over to it so greatly that the habit has become deeply ingrained. And so the struggle to overcome it has to be sustained and constant over the course of time until it's uprooted. The fathers are often fond of using that image of a sapling. You know, when it's small, we could yank it out, roots and all, and so it has no effect upon us. But once it's grown into a full tree that we can't wrap our mind or our arms around, that, you know, no matter how hard we pull, we're not going to yank that tree out of the ground. And so the longer that we have been exposed ourselves to certain thoughts or images, the more we are going to have to rely upon the grace of God. And the more heroic, in a sense, the virtue is going to have to become in order to draw us back to where we need to be. And I think that's where, you know, the real battleground for us going into the future is going to be, I think, with this kind of hypersensuality and the ability of people to achieve purity of heart. But there's just so much there that fills the mind and the heart that it becomes very difficult. And I've mentioned this to you before about the one modern elder saying that those who achieve purity of heart in our day are going to be like the martyrs of old, that it's going to take that heroic virtue that allowed them to be willing to endure the grace of tortures, you know, for the love of Christ, that is going to be needed by those who are engaging in this battle with this fierce enemy that has permeated our culture in such a great way that we have to have this kind of heroic discipline and fidelity to prayer and this watchfulness and sobriety that Theophanes has been talking about here. Yes, Anthony or Andrea?
Yeah, you were just mentioning, Father, about the image of the tree, and you know the part that can sometimes be discouraging is when, you know, you have this big, developed, full sequoia, then what do you do? It can become very discouraging to see it. You don't even know where to start. Mm-hmm. So
that's right.
Where do you start?
I think you start in the confessional. And I think that's why Philip Neri and some of the other saints started there, that the, you know, our greatest source of strength is going to come from Christ himself and the means that he's given us for healing. And so Philip began in the confessional and staying in there and have people going to confession weekly, sometimes multiple times a week, for certain individuals, even daily, depending upon what it is that they were struggling with and the depth of the affliction or the illness, if the spiritual illness, if you will. And then the context of that, I think he also gave spiritual counsel, and he was very well versed and immersed in the Desert Fathers, you know, both in terms of, you know, their writings, but more importantly, in terms of how they lived their life. Experientially, he knew and practiced what they had practiced despite living in the city. And it's this that allowed him, the experiential knowledge that gave him the ability to be a great guide within the confessional. But I think for all of us, it is, you know, he also said that outside of the Holy Eucharist, there is no chastity. That it's only by this divine love and grace that we are capable of overcoming this deep affliction that we bear. And so it is through the healing of these two healing sacraments, you know, the going to confession and then receiving Holy Communion frequently, which again was new in Philip's time, you know, in the sense of the frequency of receiving Holy Communion, is through these means that one gains strength and to enter in to the spiritual battle. And I think he taught them as well to see their life as living from Eucharist to Eucharist. So, you know, receiving the grace of the sacrament, engaging in the spiritual battle, fostering all these means, you know, they would read the lives of the saints, or they would read Cassian and Climacus, talk about them, you know, they would engage in all these spiritual activities. He would take the time that was most dangerous for them, the siesta hours, and make himself really accessible to them, but also foster these spiritual exercises for them in order to engage them in the faith. And then gradually, you know, all these great saints begin to emerge. It was sort of curious that, you know, oratorians don't take vows. And yet it's said that, you know, it was often commented by those who led the religious communities at the time. Like Phillips would send a lot of men to the Jesuits and to the Dominicans. And they would often visit the, you know, these communities to participate in their vespers and things such as that. But it was often commented that the obedience that Philip's disciples and then eventually community members had was greater than those who lived the vowed life, because it was so rooted in this love that they had for him and the attention that he gave in their formation. And so, you know, these are some of the places that I think we would want to begin, you know, with what Christ himself has given us. And just in general, I think we want to begin all things with Christ, you know, and faced with the enormity of the battle. I think what alone can give us hope is the love of Christ and the grace that he gives us, that, you know, that he has given everything and desires our salvation above all things, and that we aren't on the battlefield alone. Because once, if we begin struggling and entering into this battle and lose sight of Christ, you know, if we get so absorbed in just how terrible we are, you know, which can happen, you know, when we see all these things and are overwhelmed by them, we can be drawn into this despondency. And so we really have to link the ascetical life to the life of prayer intimately. Otherwise, we are going to be drawn into a kind of darkness when we face the reality of our own poverty. But when Christ is the center of that and we're clinging to him, even if we face and are humbled by our weakness, you know, it's never outside of that context or the context of his mercy. And so we're able to, you know, to step back into the battle, enter back into the fray as often as we fall. Okay. Carl or Sawyer.
It's actually me again. I was going to say, one of the things that I have been noticing lately is the quality of my hardness of heart. And when I focus on softening that through the Jesus prayer or the confession, I mean, any of those things, but when I'm really focusing on the softening my heart, then the ascetical practices seem to flow a lot easier. I think that's kind of
a good point. You know, in the first volume of the Philokleia, I can't remember which father it is now, describes the Jesus prayer as having that effect and fruit, that as the rain, you know, falling on the earth softens the ground. So the Jesus prayer, you know, continually being said, softens the heart. And so, you know, it's another reason, I think, why they gravitated to this prayer, because they could see that taking place, that this constant remembrance of God, but also calling on the name of Jesus, there's something there that softens the heart and makes it more pliable to the grace of God and teachable, you know, in the sense of receiving the wisdom of the gospel. Okay. So I have 8:36. So the hour flew by, but a very, very rich discussion. Thank you again for all your questions and comments. I mean, it's beautiful. And, but this is, you know, an extraordinary letter. And so try to glean as much as you can from it and maybe go back and read it again. Okay. So when we close with the Our Father as always, in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you.
And with
your spirit. May the Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen.
Shalom, peace. Thanks be to God.
Thanks.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Good class.
Okay, thank you. And I want to bring something up because I've heard from multiple people, you know, about the difference between the two groups and the two works that we're reading. You know, St. Theophan, that is very accessible, these letters, very intimate and straightforward. And then the Evagrius, that is at times plodding and really makes you work. And it's something that is going to be a labor over the course of years. Because with one letter, we've seen the skill of Theophan, you know, drawing her into the tradition and so skillfully articulating it that he opens this whole world up to her. Whereas the Evagrius is written in this different way. You know, we are, there's a hypothesis, there was a brilliance in the compiler, that monk Paul, in putting it together under these hypotheses and drawing together the writings of these various fathers. But that means we're moving from one to another in their way of articulating it. It doesn't have that same consistency. We don't pick up the personality like we do in Theophan or that we'll pick up in St. John Climacus. You know, Climacus, you know, is very intense, but also has this great sense of humor that comes out through the text as well. But with Evagrius, you know, it is very challenging. Like we've been reading and talking about death for almost 2 months now. And it's incredibly challenging to stay in there and mm-hmm. to suspend judgment. And to say, okay, I realize that this is going to be a longer term process and that I'm going to be exposed to things that I'm only gathering a little snippet of, you know, in terms of understanding. And perhaps even some weeks it might stir up, you know, things within me and even leave me feeling a little bit more confused so that I walk away thinking, oh my gosh, you know, is this really what the faith is about? And it can be unsettling. And so one has to be prepared for that. You know, it's a different kind of reading, and we have to bear with a kind of tension that it creates within the mind and the heart in order, I think, to be able to sustain our path through it over the course of years, because it is going to take us years. I don't know how many years, but hopefully I'll make it through it with you all before kicking the bucket. But nonetheless, that suspension of judgment, where we say, okay, you know, we are praying, here's a group, we are looking back to the tradition of the elders that is rooted in this deep experience of God, and we are listening in this very prayerful way, but we have to suspend judgment because we know that we're not going to come to any kind of conclusion or closure, as we do often with these letters, or with St. John Climacus coming to the end of one of the steps that he describes, that for us, it is often going to be this longer process of seeing a sort of a painting gradually come together, where we begin to recognize features. It's like a portrait. We're watching a portrait being painted. And there are certain times, I don't know if you've seen those artists sometimes who paint really quickly, and you think, what the heck is that? It looks like scribbles, and then they turn it upside down, and all of a sudden you see this image that they had been working on. But the whole time, it was just, it looked like, you know, a scribbled mess to you. And that's going to be the feeling at times, I think, when we go through it. And so I think what I want, I've heard this enough from enough people that I just want to be able to say it for some of you who participate in both groups, that it's fine, you know, to feel that way and not to become discouraged with it. And I'm never hesitant to hear people say, you know, this doesn't ring true, or this seems to be too harsh or too much of a generalization, you know, or to pull it apart. You know, I think we are meant to be discriminating and discerning in our reading. And there's no reason for any of us to be afraid of the truth. And so to put forward the questions and really struggle with it is a good thing. And I think we're so used to wanting, you know, approaching things almost in a consumeristic kind of way. We want, you know, just give me, you know, the truth in this little paragraph with a bunch of pictures around it. And like a comic book. Well, there is no Evergantino's comic book. We have to go through this process that can be a little bit painful at times. So I guess while I'm going through this is just to say, don't lose heart with it. It is a much different kind of text, but I think it's this incredible source, you know, and something so beautiful that throughout the course of that process and if coming out the other end, it's going to be so nourishing for everyone. And so to stick with it and encourage others to stick with it too, and even to bring new people into it. I think no matter when they come along, I think there's always going to be something in there that is nourishing. Okay. But here too, in this group, I never want anybody to hesitate to bring up a question about something that, you know, makes you uncomfortable or that needs to be unpacked a little bit more. Okay. Okay, that's what I had to say. Anybody have any comments on that, or dump the Evergantinos? No,
definitely don't do that.
I know. We bought those four volumes. You're stuck now with those four volumes that you paid all that money for. That was my ploy to get paid to pay $100 for these four volumes. So, okay, and never hesitate to write an email or something like that too, or to talk to me individually about something that we're reading. All right.
Thanks, Father.
Okay, have a great week, everybody. Yeah.